I'm going to recap what we learned yesterday and maybe the day before. So I have the primary constraint that to keep this presentation in 5 minutes. So I'm not sure if I'm gonna do it, but let me try. So yesterday we talked about the kinematical phase space. So we have a set of constraints, maybe primary, secondary, tertiary, and so on. But we can classify this our set of constraints to be the one with first class and the one with second class constraint. So what we mainly focus on is the first class constraint, which is defined by that the Poisson bracket between the first class constraint and all the constraints weakly vanish. So why we are interested in, this first class constraint? Because this first class constraint generates what we call a gauge transformation. So when our system have this kind of gauge transformation, so we have some kind of redundancy in our description. So it's not actually a symmetry, it's just a redundancy in our description. So what I mean by this redundancy, I mean that given initial condition, it doesn't uniquely determine your solution. So how can we deal with this problem? So we can work on this problem in what we call this kinematical phase space. So let's say if we have the phase space, with the phase space variable that I denoted by this. So basically you have phase space. And then you have a constraint, which is the first class constraint, zero. So basically you have the constraint surface, which is on the hypersurface in the phase space. So, and because you have this kind of gauge transformation, you can have that what I mentioned before, the redundancy to describe the physical degree of freedom. So basically you can have, at each point in the phase space, you have the, you can describe the points in the phase space by the phase space variable x, and you can have some kind of gauge orbit, which is physically equivalent in this constraint surface. So this gauge orbit is generated by the Poisson bracket. Of the phase space variable with a constant C. Yeah. So now how can we deal with this? So we need to think about what is the reasonable question that we can ask. So because we have some kind of redundancy, so the important question that we can ask, the reasonable question is about the relation between the dynamical variable. So basically you ask if one of your dynamical variable take a specific value, what is the value of the another dynamical variable? So this idea leads you to the idea of what we call gate fixing. So you need to specify a new function, a new condition that we call gate condition, which is also the function of a space variable to fix the gate. Or basically, you just pick one representation of the gauge orbit to represent your dynamical variable. So now you can ask what is the number of physical degree of freedom that you can have. So the number of the physical degree of freedom is equal to the number of kinematical degree of freedom minus the number of first class constraint minus the number of second class constraint. And because you also specify this gauge condition, you have to minus the number of gauge condition. But in general, this number of the gauge condition is equal to this number of the first class constraint. So you can maybe you can ignore this and put the two here. And yeah. So with this gate fixing, you can define what you call the observable interface. Yes. The observable is It's a phase space function, which is a Poisson commute with your constraint. So I think it is everything that you should know about the canonical phase space. And if you want to quantize it, then you go to you go from canonical phase space to what we call canonical Hilbert space. And basically, which I think we will see today, that we have the Poisson bracket replaced by the commutator, and the constraint C will be represented by the operator, which is act on the physical state, it's zero. And then you will have observable F here, will be represented by an operator with a vanishing commutator. So I get this everything. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks. So today, so we're going to exactly go step by step for the Dirac quantization program for the case of the parametric particle, and then we will go to start to talk about gravity. So, and of course, to gravity, to the case of 3D gravity. So now our system is going to be 3D gravity. And we are going to apply the same thing that we did for the parametrized particle, meaning first we're going to look at the canonical analysis of 3D gravity, and then apply the Dirac program. Okay, but let's first see what does it mean to apply the Dirac program on this simple example, which is the parametrized particle. Okay, so first, any question on what Kotarak said today.
I think I already asked, but it's not clear for me. Why we define an observable such that f, c, Poisson bracket is equal to zero?
Like, yeah, so what does it mean that you get that? This means that then this object is going to be constant along the gauge orbit. So it's not going to be modified by acting on the constraint. So this means that it's an object that is going to be invariant under the gauge transformation. Okay. It's a gauge invariant object because you satisfy that. So this is why we're interested in this kind of object, because they don't have any, they only have kind of information on the physical degrees of freedom. They don't. Okay, great. So let's now apply the different step of the program to the example of the parameterized particle. So first, the first step is to define, it's just what Kotarak said, is to define the kinematical Hilbert space. So first, what is the kinematical phase space? Here, it's, you remember that it's four-dimensional, and we have so four variables. And so this is a phase space, kinematical one. Okay. It's not the physical one. We know that we have some gauge symmetry here, and so we have some constraint. And now the question is, what is the kinematical Hilbert space? So here, this is a quite simple example of quantum mechanics that you know. So you have position and the conjugate momentum. So we're just going to consider that it's going to be the space of integrable function for these two variables, q and t. And we can use here just wave function with the inner product defined as just being the integral and so this is quite straightforward in this example, but then we need also to promote this variable to operators. Okay, so here we're just going to choose that the configuration variable, so q and t here, are going to act as multiplication operator. Okay, so configuration variable are going to become so what does it mean? This means that they act by multiplication on a given state. And the momentum variable are going to just be act by differentiation. Okay, so as you use, so it just means that PQ then is, so this is very similar to what you know for quantum mechanics. And then of course you need to check now that you indeed have this relation where here you need to have a okay, so as an exercise, here you can just check the Poisson. So now it's not the Poisson bracket, sorry, the commutator. Between all these operators. Okay, so P, Q, T, and P, Q, P. Okay, so this was the first step of the program. Define what is the kinematical Hilbert space. So for this, we need to know which kind of function we have, what is our basis. We need to have an inner product, which is defined here. And we need to promote the different phase space variable to operator. Okay, so this is the first step. Then the second step, of course, is to take care of the constraint. Because you remember, so now we start from the kinematical Hilbert, kinematical phase space, but at some point we want to go to the physical free space, and for that we need to impose some constraint. So the second step, let's call that B, is going to, so here we have only one constraint. And we're going to promote that to an operator. And here it simply become, there is no issue of ordering or anything. So it's quite simple. In most of the time, this is not so straightforward. But here we just get this differential operator. And so what is now this equation? It's a quite well-known equation. Yeah, so here you just get, okay. Equation. So usually, of course, this step is not as simple. We have some ordering measurements, this kind of thing. But here, everything is nice. And then, so we need to find now the space of solution, okay, of physical state. And so here, this means that we want to indeed solve this equation. So the solution of the quantum constraint in this case are just the solution of Schrödinger equation. And so this means that you know that you can characterize all the solution just given by specifying the initial wave function. So let's denote just an initial wave function as for some t equal t zero, and then the solution of the Schrödinger equation are simply given by so of q and t are just going to be the exponential of where here h is just the so here h is just the Hamiltonian for the free particle. Okay, so it will be the Hamiltonian that you would get from the unparametrized particle. Okay, and so now the non-trivial step here is to define what is the inner product. Okay, so the first question is, okay, so we already have an inner product coming from the kinematical Hilbert space here. Can we use this one? Okay, so can I define let's call one using the same maybe DQ. So here this is going to simplify, so it's just going to give me just the initial this can be just written in terms of the initial state, okay, initial wave function that I defined here for each of my physical state. So do you see an issue? Can you read that?
It's a bit clear.
Yeah, but then my it's going to make a noise that I don't like. So yeah, I have to compromise here. sorry about that. So it's really just so the integration over dq, because I'm using really the inner product I defined here for the kinematical space, and with this so now this part simplified, so I just gave this the product of these two states. Okay, one and two. So what can you say about that? Is it going to be well defined?
Yeah.
So this is a constant, okay, over t, and then your integral over t, which is going to give some infinite. Okay, so this is going to be infinite. So indeed, because this term is constant with respect to t. And so here you see that usually we cannot use the kinematical inner product to define the physical inner product. We have to choose really an inner product for the space of solution of the constraint. And this kind of issue is going to happen as soon as you have a kind. So here we say that the gauge, we have a gauge orbit which is non-compact, okay? Because we have this variable which can go from minus infinity to plus infinity. So as soon as you have this kind of gauge symmetry with non-compact orbit, you will, if you try to use a kinematical inner product to define your physical inner product, then you're going to get that your physical state are not normalizable. Okay, so this is not really what you want. So in this case, so then this is usually the hard question, okay? How to define the physical inner product. But here I'm going to make the story short because in this case we are dealing with this simple example of the parameterized particle, and we know what would be the solution if we were using directly the reduced phase space approach, or if you want, if you were just quantizing the unparameterized particle. Okay, so we can here use directly this inner product, but then in the case of, for example, gravity, then several approaches or several methods have been developed to try to find. So here, in fact, we know that the physical Hilbert space is just given by R and not R2, and that indeed the inner product is just given. So maybe here you're going to see. Move that. Is just given by and this is well defined. Okay, so in this case we can use what we know from the reduced phase space approach, but in other cases you see that this step can be non-trivial. Okay, so this was just to make you see that indeed we cannot in general use the same inner product.
Is it always easy that we just suppress the integration by the gauge variable, or this is just here it looks like we just suppress what is annoying, but
no, it's just that here we know that we know the solution, so this is, but it's not always the case that you can suppress just over the gauge orbit which is non-compact, and sometimes you have also different kind of gauge orbit even, and so the question is how to define the physical inner product. Here what is nice with this model is that with this parameterized particle is that you can compare different approaches, because we could quantize that using the reduced phase space approach that I mentioned yesterday, where you directly start from the reduced phase space, and then you could also even look at the path integral approach, and all the three approaches give the same solution, but this is not like a theorem that for any system the three different approaches are going to give you the same thing. Okay, and for example for gravity we don't even have one quantization which is working until the end, except in 3D where we have different approaches. That's why it is also nice to look at. Well, so in 3D here we're going just to focus on the canonical formulation, but you could also look at it's related to Chern-Simon theory, you can look at the path integral approach, so you have many different frameworks that we can compare. Okay, and then so this was the third step, and usually it's the hardest one, and then of course we have to find what are the observable. So here again we just quantize. This step is very easy. We just quantize the two independent variable that we defined yesterday. So we just get two operators here, and you can check that indeed so let's call it F again. So exercise, this is quite straightforward. Check that Fi with C, the commutator is equal to 0. Okay? Any question on this part? So here we will use the Dirac program step by step for the parameterized particle. So now we are going to do the same thing for 3D gravity, but each step is going to usually take at least one lecture. So at some point maybe I'm going to be lost. So that's why I wanted first to give you how it works on a simple system that you kind of have in mind what are it, what we are looking for. Okay, and so even before starting to do the canonical analysis of gravity, of 3D gravity, I'm going to spend some time to look at why 3D gravity, what are the characteristics of 3D gravity. And as I told you, we are not going to use the metric formulation of gravity, but we're going to use a formulation in terms of a triad, or in 4D it will be a tetrad, and a connection, a SU2 connection. So I'm going first to spend some time today on how we start from what you know, meaning which is the metric formulation, I guess. Or are you all familiar with the Palatini action, for example, for written in terms of a connection and you are, but you...
I think Ruth introduced it in her course, if I remember well.
Okay.
She introduced the field binds and that, because she used that to calculate the Riemann tensor more quickly.
Okay, so everyone...
We didn't write the action in terms of it.
And she was quite very hurt.
Oh, well, yeah. She didn't write the action.
Okay, so are you interested in doing kind of looking how we do this change of variable? And okay, so maybe I'm going to start doing it, and then if you know, you just stop me and say, oh, this is obvious, we already know that. So first, so now we're going to look at what are the actions for gravity. But that's good if you're already familiar with the triad, or I guess it was tetrad in the 4D case, and the notion of connection. It's going to help a lot. So let's just start maybe with just Einstein-Hilbert action. So even in 4D, because for the what I'm going to say at the beginning is not going to be any, is not related to the dimension of my phase space. Okay, we're here. I'm just going from now to consider that. So this kappa here is like written in terms of the gravitational, but I'm going to put it to 1 from now. Then R is the Ricci scalar, G is the determinant of the metric. And so here you see that in this expression, so the action is a functional of the metric or the inverse metric. At the classical level, it's the same thing to consider that the metric or the inverse metric. Then at the quantum level, maybe you will have some subtlety, but let's. So here you see that what is important is just that the fundamental field is the metric. And the equation of motion, of course, are obtained by varying this action. So I'm not going to do all the steps. You're going to do some of the steps in the tutorial discussion to rework a bit with indices and this kind of stuff. But so what you get here is that because we are in the vacuum, so we get the vacuum Einstein equation, which is just that the Einstein tensor, which is defined as And so this is the equation of motion from here. Okay. And this is equivalent, in fact, just to say that the Ricci tensor. So do you see how to go from here to here? Is it obvious? Maybe. That's okay. How do you prove that?
Well, you can
contraction.
Yeah, you have to contract the G minu again.
Yeah, or you take the trace here. Okay. And then as soon as the dimension of the space is greater than 2, then you this is not going to cancel. So you're just going to see that R, the Ricci color, is 0. So just this term. Okay. Okay, very good. So these are the vacuum Einstein equation. And so here it can be 4D or 3D, in fact. So let's just move to 3D with like up. This is 3D. Exactly the same. You get the same equation of motion. But now a fundamental difference in between 3D and 4D is that the curvature tensor in 3D is going to depend linearly in this Ricci tensor. So here in 3D now, so this was valid for any, here it could be n, different from 2. But now if n is equal to 3, what we're going to get is that the fact that r mu nu is equal to 0, since the curvature tensor can be expressed linearly in terms of this one, which is not the case in 4D, you get that the curvature tensor, so sigma, okay, is going to be equal to 0. And you can also check that by just doing a kind of quick counting of a number of independent components of this object. So how many? So here, what are the properties of this curvature tensor? So you know that it's symmetric under the exchange of the first two indices. So here we have how many pair of antisymmetric do you have when you start with three objects?
Three.
Yeah, three. So here we have three coming from here. Then here you have the same thing, okay? So this means that here these two could be replaced by just one index running from 1 to 3. And you can do the same with these two, which are also antisymmetric. And then you know that it's symmetric by exchanging these two pairs. So how many? So now you have three indices here. How many symmetric pairs do you have? 6. Okay. And indeed, this is also three, and symmetric. So you also have 6 independent components. Okay.
I never know this, but we don't have like a Bianchi identity, and why doesn't it reduce from 1? I never know this kind of stuff.
No, but here, so in 3D, it's going to be automatically. So the no, so which so there is an additional, you mean we have an additional property which is a totally antisymmetric. No, maybe not the that this is totally antisymmetric and this vanishes automatically in 3D. So but then so I will come back maybe later. Point. Okay, so this was just to show that indeed this, if we compare the number of independent components in these two objects, these are the same in 3D. Okay. So what does it mean here? This means that in 3D, every solution of the vacuum Einstein equation, when you don't have any cosmological constant, which is what I consider here, then is going to be flat. Okay. And if you add the cosmological constant, then this means that your solutions are going to have constant curvature. So indeed, in 3D, we don't have, so why 3D gravity is so simple is that we don't have any local degrees of freedom, okay? And we say that 3D gravity is a topological theory, and the only degrees of freedom we are going to have are the global one, which are going to depend on the topology of your space-time here. And so if the topology of space-time is trivial, then you don't have any, there is no gravitational degrees of freedom at all. But then, so how do we characterize, so let's maybe just mention that because it's going so here. The solution is that there is no local degrees of freedom. And curvature, if you have some curvature, is going to be concentrated at the location of matter. But here we're going to consider the case first without matter. And so we're going to have only global degrees of freedom, which are going to be related to the topology of the manifold. Okay? So how do we characterize the topology of the manifold? It, usually we say that it's so. By the fundamental group, and so what is roughly the fundamental group? The fundamental group is going to count the number of non-trivial of distinct closed curve. Okay, so for example, if you are on the plane, any closed curve can be deformed into another one without breaking the curve. Okay, so indeed, in the fundamental group for the plane has only one group element, which is just an entity. So we said that in this case, this is trivial. Then, which other surface do we have? We have the sphere, and the sphere again. On the sphere, you can deform any closed curve to another one. So again, the topology of the sphere is trivial. And so in 3D, usually we're going to say that our space-time can be written like this. Okay, where here we have it's our 2D surface. And this is always possible as soon as you consider most of the space-time we're going to observe can do this decomposition. And so this is a 2D surface. And the topology of 2D surfaces is classified. So in 3D, it's going to be easy. We need that any orientable surface is isomorphic either to a sphere or the connected sum of some tori. Okay, so then, and then you're going to characterize your surface by the genus of your surface, which is more or less the number of holes you have. And so this is going to be related to the number of tori you have. And what else can I say here? Yeah, maybe just an example of non-trivial topology.
Sigma can be the sphere or the torus.
Yeah, or a connected sum of tori. Okay.
Or like glued together, or plane.
Yeah, but usually, yeah. So usually, we're going to consider here more or less compact surface, not to have any issue with the boundary condition. But then, so what is a torus? Torus, like it's like a donut. Yeah, and so it can be built, in fact. A flat torus can be built from a piece of flat paper. So this means that a torus is just going to be something where you're going to identify these two sides and identify. Yeah, this is a bit short, but you see the idea. You identify also this one, and then you get your torus. So let me maybe just put torus. So you identify this with this, and this side with this side. And so you see that then this is going to give you I don't know if it's very well. But this is supposed to be a torus. And so here you see that here you have two, you're going to get two parameters because this curve, so around this length, and the curves here cannot be deformed into one another. Okay. And so here, if you were trying to do some gravity on a torus, you will end up with two parameters, which are going to be the length of this curve. And the equation of motion are going then to tell you the how the lengths of this curve are going to evolve. So this is just the first example of non-trivial topology in 3D would be to consider.
But the lengths of the two curves are what you call the global properties?
Yeah. Okay, so the fact that here we don't have any local degrees of freedom, the curvature tensor is equal to zero, make that 3D gravity is much simpler than 4D gravity. And again, as I already mentioned, what is interesting with 3D gravity is that we have several approaches. We know how to quantize it exactly, okay? And we have even several approaches to quantize. So here we're going to look at the loop quantum gravity approach, and hopefully at the end of the course, the spin foam approach, but there are many papers to compare with Chertainman or different kind of where in Chertainman you have different way to also quantize using either the path integral approach or a canonical approach too. So then we have several framework that we can compare. So it's often interesting to ask questions in the 3D context and compare what we get. Okay, so as I said, we don't want to stay with this formulation, but we want now to go to the first order formulation. So what is the idea of the first order formulation? So instead of using the metric as our fundamental field, now at each point of space-time, I'm going to consider an orthonormal frame. Okay, at each point of space-time, and this is what I'm going to call the triad. And you can so now let's go to the first order formulation. And so instead of looking at Gmu as my fundamental field, now at each point of space-time, I'm going to introduce a small, at each point of space-time, now I'm going to a small frame, okay? And I can use this frame to, in fact, I can define, the metric can be seen as the pullback of this on of the flat metric. So what is, let me, new. We are going to work in the Euclidean framework, so I'm not going to work with eta mu nu, but just delta ij, okay, because it's Euclidean. And what should I say? So here they're going to satisfy some orthonormality condition, and this is so the triad. Yeah, the triad is this way. Sorry. So this is what we call the triad, and is the co-triad. Okay. So let's just look at this first. So here, how many components do I have, 3D?
We have total 9.
For Gmu? Yeah, 6. It's symmetric, okay? So you have 6, and here, for one object, how many? So here, I is also is what we call the internal index, and can also take the value 1, 2, 3. So how many components do I have when I'm considering the triad? It's 9. So you can already see that Here we have introduced some irrelevant information. We have more degrees of freedom. So this means that going from this formulation to this formulation, we're going to have an additional symmetry, okay? An additional gauge symmetry. And so knowing that this is like a small frame, which is set at each point of your spacetime, you see which symmetry we're going to introduce here?
SO3.
Yeah, okay, it's a rotation, because you can rotate your frame. And we're going to just, as an exercise, you can check, but I can write this for you if you want.
So you mean that at each point we have...
Yeah, so here it's X, X.
I don't understand the interpretation of the internal index.
So what do you mean you don't understand?
The three arrows that you have drawn, like here, what?
So here it's like on the, more or less on the tangent space, if you want, okay? And then you have this. And indeed here, it's a rotation. It's invariant under rotation, but for the rotation in the internal space. Okay, so what is the transformation that we have, additional transformation that we have here, is that we can define, we can rotate where R here is an element of SO3. And you can show that indeed, if you write now, same thing here, a mu prime prime L mu mu delta K L. And so if you use the transformation we just introduced, so L oh, I have L, okay. So this is a rotation. So this means that here you have that R transpose with R is equal to identity. Okay, and so indeed this you recover and you have here delta KL. And so you recover exactly J mu nu here. Okay. So indeed, this transformation is not going to change the metric. So this is an additional symmetry we're going to have. OK, so this means that now, instead of working with this as our fundamental field, I'm going to work with the triad. Okay, but so what does it mean? This also means that now this triad carries these internal indices. And so you know that in a curved spacetime, to do vector analysis, you need a metric. So here, for the internal space, we have the flat metric. Okay, but you also know you also need a connection. Okay, and this has to be given to you. So in the case of general relativity, since you're working, you're interested in Riemannian geometry, then in the connection, in this case for Riemannian geometry, this means that you need a connection which is torsion-free and metric compatible, and this in fact is going to define uniquely your connection. Okay, but this is because you're interested in Riemannian geometry, and in fact we're going to see that working with the tetrad and the connection here SU2, it's going to be, we are going to introduce a new connection, a SU2 connection. In fact, you can work with more general geometry, which are geometry of the type of Cartan, okay? Which are going to, what is the, going to be the new ingredient allowed in this framework, which is not allowed in Riemann geometry, is that you're going to allow some torsion, additional torsion, okay? So the framework we're going to construct is in fact even more general than just working with the metric formulation, okay? So indeed, so to do some, vector analysis, so you need a metric and you need the connection. Because why do you need the connection? You want to relate, to connect points on your space-time or on your manifold, which are close together enough, because then you want to define what is the notion of derivative. Okay? So here, you know that for the space-time indices, you have the Levi-Civita connection to use to define the covariant derivative. Okay? And because then, and the notion of covariant derivative is going to allow you to parallel transport your object. But now we want also to move or to connect together objects in on the internal space. And so for this, we need to add an additional connection, okay, which is going to be what we call the spin connection. So this was for the first order formulation. The first ingredient we need is triads or tetrads. This is, and the second ingredient we need is the notion of a connection. Okay, so for space-time, so these are the space-time indices. You already have a connection, which is the Levi-Civita connection. This is your connection, which is torsion. Torsion-free and metric compatible, and this defines the standard covariant derivative. Okay, and so now we need something similar because now we also have which are internal indices. And so this has to be given to you to parallel transport your object with internal indices. So what are the two ingredients we want here? We want to parallel transport objects with parallel indices, but we also want to ensure that once we act with a covariant derivative, then the way these objects are going to transform under rotation, internal rotation, are going to also transform well. Okay, because you remember one of the motivations to introduce this covariant derivative is here, if you start with a tensor, then you want that this, when you act with the derivative, then it's still a tensor, okay? And so this means that what you are looking for is that it still transforms well under change of coordinate, okay? So now this is, of course, for general relativity, where the important symmetry is the diffeomorphism symmetry. Now we add this new rotation symmetry for the internal indices. So we also want a covariant derivative, which is going to be, which is going to the object we're going to get when we act with this covariant derivative are going to be objects which transform well under the rotation method. Okay, so these are the two things. So with the covariant derivative, so we're going to define a new covariant derivative. So here we need a new connection, which is going to be the spin connection. We're going to get a new covariant derivative, and what we want is to parallel transport object with internal indices. And we also want that if we act on this object still transform well under rotation, which were really also the two ingredients you have in the covariant derivative. Okay, the two motivations. You cannot read. Sorry. Maybe I'm going to move. We're going to move very soon there.
Like transform rotation. That like the rotation commute with the DMU.
Yeah, so in fact, at the end, it's going to, but here you remember that you want that any, if you act on a tensor with this covariant derivative, with the space, with this standard covariant derivative, then this is still a tensor. So what does it mean that it's a tensor? This means that it's still, it's transformed as a tensor under change of coordinate. Okay? And here, now the important transformation for the internal indices is the rotation. So for example, this is the upper index. This upper internal index is going to be what we call a vector for the rotation. Okay, so it's going to be under rotation. It's going just to transform as a vector under a rotation. And you want that this object still going to transform as a vector.
You have R, G, J, K,
yeah,
stuff. And if it's also a tensor because it has a mu.
Yeah, now it's going to be, it's going to, so yeah, we're going to have that this is still going to, it's going to be a tensor, but this object is also going to still be a vector for the internal index. Okay, so this is what I mean, but transform well under rotation. Okay, so let's, define this covariant derivative maybe, and then we'll see. So let's just see. So I'm going to define this covariant derivative and see how it's going to act on, let's take the example of space-time scalar and covector with an internal index. So let's look at this object. So this is a scalar for space-time, but it's a, we could also look at this transformation, and if now we have a covector for space-time, and it's still okay. So let's define this object and then be able to generalize. So here, this is the derivative of this, and we're going to add the contribution by the spin connection. And now, if instead of a vector for the internal index, we have this covector, let's take here K, J, and so here. This is what we call the spin connection. And yeah, you can check that this relation between the two, you can use this object to form a scalar for the index. And if it's a scalar, of course, you want that as a scalar, you only want this part. Okay? If d mu on something like this, since this is now a scalar, okay, you expect that this is just this. So this is just to give you that, if I'm giving you that, you should be able to find what is this relation, just using the fact that you want this.
We have a bit Leibniz rule.
Yeah. And here, so now this carry space-time index and an internal index. So we're going to get the contribution from the Levi-Civita connection. So let's not take the same index. Plus the contribution.
You mean V?
Sorry?
At the end.
Yeah. I mean the same object. Yeah, I started this. Okay, so as I said, so in the case of general relativity, the fact that we asked that, so we're working with Riemann geometry, so we want this connection to be torsionless and metric compatible, and these conditions are sufficient to determine uniquely the connection in terms of the metric. Okay, so usually when you know the metric, if you know that you're dealing with Riemann geometry, then you have your connection. Okay, you don't need this to be added. Here it seems that so this problem right now is introduced as an additional ingredient you need to perform covariant derivative. But we can ask a condition which is going to be quite useful if we demand this following, which are conditions that we're going to call compatibility condition and compatibility condition, which is that the covariant derivative is going to annihilate the triad. Then the spin connection can be uniquely completely determined by the Levi-Civita connection and the triad. By the Levi-Civita connection and triad. So I'm going to give you the expression and just also give you why also this condition is interesting, and then I guess it will be the end over time. So you just get you can check that you get this definition. And also why this condition is interesting. So in fact, using the cotriad here, if you contract the cotriad with any an object with only space-time indices, is going to change your object with space-time indices to an object with internal indices. Okay, and the fact that this is equal to zero means that now this operation is going to commute with the derivative. So this means that you can change internal space-time indices to internal indices outside this covariant derivative or inside the covariant derivative. Okay, so so this means now that, so for example, if I have an object, let's just take V mu, okay, I can go, so this is space-time, but I can now look at this object as a internal with an object only with internal index, okay? And so if now I want to apply the covariant derivative on this object or on this object, meaning I can do that, or I can do, let's choose another component here, that inside or outside is mu, and we get the same thing, okay, because we have this compatibility condition. So this is quite interesting. And yeah, so tomorrow I'm going to give you also what the fact that we use this compatibility, what are the consequences on this spin connection, and what are the geometrical interpretation of these consequences.
So the two states that you rely by the arrow, they are equal.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Maybe you didn't mention it, but the first triad in there has an upper index that has a Greek index, and the lower index is Latin.
Yeah.
So it's just that this one is the inverse of the normal ones, or?
So the triad is defined as this one. This is the triad, And then this is the co-triad, and indeed it's the inverse of the other. Okay? And you use, so this is co-triad. This was your question, or?
Mm-hmm. Not?
And of course, to lower our, and this is you use the metric. So here you use GMUnu to go from here to here. And here you use the internal index. You use the internal metric, which is the flat metric. So since we are Euclidean, it's just a delta. Then it would be Lorentzian. You would have to be careful because it would be eta mu nu. So you would have a sine something. But here we are just dealing with, for simplicity, we choose Euclidean signature. Okay. Okay.